You've been listening to Paradigms, the radio show and podcast that brings you inspiring people with visions of a viable future for life on Earth that includes humans.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO's Slavic Community Hour is looking for new collective members. The Slavic Community Hour is an interactive news, talk, and music program focused on Portland's Ukrainian and Russian community. No experience is required, just an enthusiasm for Slavic culture and a desire to learn. If you speak Ukrainian or Russian and have an interest in community radio, please reach out to program@kboo.org to learn more. That's program@kboo.org.
Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, did Sonoma County sheriffs jump the gun in the recent killing of farm worker David Perez Chavez and then try and cover it up with a professionally edited video? We're going to take a look at that. Also, Filipino activists planning to protest the invitation of President Marcos of Philippines to the United Nations. They say he isn't the legitimate president, and they have a lot to say about that. Also, the fight to WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange continues. We'll be joined by staunch Assange defender Randy Credico, producer of Countdown to Freedom, and also local organizer Jeff Mackler. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We broadcast every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. We are live today in San Francisco and Los Angeles, and we are happy to have you along with us. Well, David Perez Chavez, a 36-year-old farm worker, was shot and killed by the Sonoma County Sheriff's Deputy Michael Dietrich about 10 a.m. Friday, July 29th, after a 45-minute foot chase through rugged terrain near Geyserville. That's in Northern California, north of San Francisco, for those listening outside the state. After the shooting, the Sonoma County Sheriff's Office quickly sent a raw body camera footage from the incident to a civilian public relations company. 2 weeks later, the firm had produced an edited 11.5-minute video using selections from the more than 2.5 hours of body camera footage. The video outlined the sheriff's office narrative of the shooting and was posted to the agency's Facebook and YouTube page on August 14th. Didn't make local activists happy. Local reform activists, however, their response was to describe the video as a propaganda and a sort of a public relations cover-up of the killing. We're going to be talking about that today, and joining us to help shed some life and light on that is local attorney Isaac Schweiger. He has taken on the case and has been following it closely. He has been representing other victims of police violence and alleged police violence. It is good to have you back with us, Mr. Schweiger.
Good to be back on the show.
All right, well, can you just take us back a little bit and share with us the basics of the story? What happened? How was this farm worker? I guess he was here a year in the United States. This was sort of supposed to be the beginning of his dream, but it ended with a bullet to the body that took his life. He was apparently, well, tell us what happened.
Well, you know, it ended with three bullets, and it tragically. We don't know a lot of what preceded David's contact with the sheriff's deputies, but we do know that he was not more than a hypothetical danger to anyone out there. David was a father. He was a husband, and he left a family back in Mexico so that he, like so many other people, desperate for a better life for their loved ones. He came to this country. He came to California, and he worked his fingers to the bone. He sent money back every month to provide for his loved ones because they lacked the ability to do so for themselves. Whatever happened immediately before David encountered the sheriff's deputies, we may never know, but we do know that he was in some kind of crisis, and he was either in some kind of a mental health crisis, possibly a drug-induced crisis. We don't know. We will know more when the toxicology reports come back on the autopsy. Those are not yet available. But whether it was drugs or whether it was mental health or an emotional crisis, we know he was not doing well. I mean, you can see that in the videos. And you have this man who is, screaming, "You're trying to kill me. You're trying to kill me," while he's barefoot running away from the police. And how does the story end? Well, they do just what he said that they were going to do, and they killed him. He was shot, once in the ear, a bullet lodged inside of his brain, once in the chest and once in the arm, for, frankly, not a very clear justification. I mean, you can see on these videos, and I'll be quick to say, I'm not one to say that every police killing is a murder. You know, many people do, especially activists, especially civil rights lawyers, and they'll stand up and they'll call every police killing a murder. Some definitely are, but not all of them. But that said, when I watched this video, it appeared to me to be little more than an execution. There was no exigency that required the use of deadly force, none whatsoever. And a husband and a father is dead now on account of it.
So he was having... he was in crisis, and really what's also in crisis is this police department, because we've been covering them for a while, and departments across the country when it comes to dealing with somebody who's having a mental crisis and needs help. And it so often, like this one, turns into an execution. Did he hurt anybody before they executed him? Did he hurt anybody?
Not that they're reporting. And you better bet that if he had, that's the first thing they would have reported. I mean, when you started off, Dennis, you mentioned, these accusations of propaganda. When the sheriff's office in Sonoma County issued their press release shortly after David's death, they went to some pretty extreme ends to dehumanize the man before they said that they had killed him. To make people afraid, so they said that he was screaming incoherently. They said that he, had what appeared to be a weapon. They said that he charged at the deputies. Oh my God, he had, none of those things are true, and we can see it in the video. He never charged at the deputies, never. Whenever you see a statement like this in a police press release, he appeared to have a weapon. The only logical conclusion you should draw from that is that he did not have a weapon. And in fact, that's what the case was here.
There was some object they started talking about that was...
He had garden tools in his hands. They claimed that he had a rock in the other hand. I was speaking with a partner of mine about this and questioning how many times as a child, we've all had rocks thrown at us at the playground, and how often that justified the use of deadly force in return. And of course, the answer is never. But in the video, you can see that he's holding this rock and he puts it down on the ground, and that's when he's shot. So the threat that he posed to deputies was speculative, if it existed at all.
Speculative. All right, let's talk a little bit about this. It's sort of unusual, this the sheriff sends out to have a professional video made, and I guess a couple of hours turns into 11 and a half minutes. You think they covered the situation well? What's your take on the video?
But, well, I mean, there's a playbook that, you know, and you said unusual, I would have agreed with you 5 years ago, but frankly, this is becoming the norm. You have these, you know, departments that have a dedicated budget for public relations that is really just whitewashing. It's, you know, what we're starting to call copaganda. And here we have this this incident where, you know, of course, the same is true in journalism as it is in a situation like this, where there is value in primacy. You know, if you're going to be the first person to tell the story, that's what people are going to remember. So if you make the deceased out to be scary or a criminal or he did this wrong or he did that, and, you know, that's what people are going to remember. And of course, they'll back the rest of the information, you know, until the news cycles are done. So everyone gets the press release. They run with the press release. You know, that's what most media outlets will do. They'll just parrot the press release back in almost exactly the same words. And then everyone thinks, well, the shooting was justified. Then 2 weeks later, 2 months later, 2 years later, when the video comes out unedited, everyone's forgotten the story and no one's interested anymore because that was yesterday's news. So the sheriff's department, like many other police departments in California and around the nation, try to get in front of these things with primacy. Tell the story through their lens. Don't show how they messed up at all, right? And then we're going to, you know, fight you on all of our public records and Freedom of Information Act requests to keep the real information from coming out for as long as possible. That is just the name of the game. And it's become standard in Sonoma County, at least with the sheriff's office. We haven't seen it from other agencies yet, but it's growing to be the practice around the state.
It's interesting because I guess they're coming at this from both sides. One, in limiting the distance, how close people can come who are filming, and that's going to become it's already becoming a big controversy. And now, larger and larger budgets to make their own reality of what happened. And so how would you, if you didn't know much and you saw the video, what would you think, and why would you be being misled?
Well, you know, the biggest takeaway is that we have two different police officers who are in pursuit, working in tandem, and we've got both of their body-worn cameras. One of them used deadly force, and one of them does not. And that should immediately, you know, raise the question of why did one think it was justified? Or did one even bother to think it was justified? And it's important to know in this case that the officer who used deadly force had recently been cleared in another officer-involved shooting that resulted in the death of another Lake County man. That was a few years back. So we have one officer who is using something the police experts call time, talk, and tactics. And that is, you know, you're trying to diffuse a situation that has no exigency. Like I said, there's no real emergency building here. It's not like they have to act or someone will be hurt. They're out in the middle of nowhere. No one's around. They got all the time in the world. There's a police helicopter on standby. They got backup everywhere. So one guy is using time, talk, and tactics. Now, he doesn't speak David's language. Neither deputy did. But he's trying with, I would say, mixed results to, you know, call him amigo or senor or whatever, trying to diffuse the situation. And he's keeping his distance, taking his time, and just letting the situation evolve. And he's not going to get right up next to him because he doesn't know what's going to happen, but he doesn't need to be next to him because there's no exigency. Then you got the other guy who, he's got his gun out. He's ready to go deadly force at a moment's notice. And he just starts yelling when Mr. Pelaez Chavez comes into his field of view, just starts yelling at him in English, drop it, get on the ground, drop it. And then I think 8 seconds after he makes contact with him, shoots him 3 times, one in the head, one in the chest, one in the arm. The difference between those two deputies. Yeah. And the difference
eight seconds and 3 shots. And you said the first one went through the ear.
Yeah, that's what
so
it looks
he
like.
Was I mean, executed we're not sure. after he put again. So he was executed after he put his rock down. One cop Correct. Shot, one sheriff shot, and one didn't. I just wanted to make sure we got this. Go on. I mean, this is sort of troubling.
I mean, that's a big takeaway. Is, you know, you have one deputy who is Again, I'm not one to offer these guys a lot of slack. I am not an apologist for police misconduct, but you really see one deputy using proper police training to approach the situation, and one who, well, frankly, is a killer and has no business on the job like that.
So you have one deputy who is trying to speak a little Spanish, doing his best, I guess, to communicate in a community. We should remind people, if you're listening out of the direct area, is largely or many Spanish-speaking people in this community. This is farm worker country, if you will. And this was a farm worker. So that he's trying to speak Spanish, and then the other guy is screaming at him in English. Were both these deputies white?
Yes, they were.
So they're screaming at him. One is screaming, one is trying to talk a little bit. They gave him 8 seconds, and it was an 8-second execution for some kind of imagined violence that didn't happen against anybody.
No one was hurt except for the man who was killed. No one was attacked except for the man who was killed. There was no indication of violence except from the deputy who did the killing. Now, I will tell you, the body-worn camera footage that we've seen so far does not seem at all to follow the narrative that the sheriff's office gave. And I think that they knew from the beginning, even before they released the videos, the edited versions and then later the unedited versions, they knew that this was a bad shooting. And that's why they approached it the way they did, by saying, here, I've got their press release right in front of me here. The man initially appeared to charge at one of the deputies. It's nowhere in the videos at all, that he appeared to have a weapon. No, he didn't. He appeared to have garden tools in his hand and a rock in the other, yelling that the deputies were there to kill him. I mean, this is a situation where a man was in obvious crisis. He had all the time in the world. There was no emergency whatsoever until the police made one.
So what is the family saying? I guess this was certainly bad news down south. What is what are his supporters? Was the family saying, are they troubled by this video and this obvious, what appears to be an obvious cover-up? Are you moving forward with legal action? What's the deal there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can only imagine if this was your family member. The family is absolutely distraught. And David had family, locally in Sonoma County and in Lake County as well.
He had has roots here.
Mm-hmm. And, oh, my gosh. I mean, of course, they feel that David was treated like an animal, that he was not given the dignity that they would treat a dog with. And I don't think that they're very far off the mark with that statement. But, and this is not something that we've mentioned before, Dennis, but it's important. Shortly after David's death, the family was contacted by the Mexican consulate in San Francisco. And the Mexican consulate asked them not to sue. Don't bring a legal action, because that might jeopardize our relationship with the county sheriff. That's
really?
Just beyond the pale. Just beyond the
pale. You've confirmed that? You have confirmed?
Well, that's what the family is telling me directly. And I have no reason to
suggest. This is what the family is saying.
I have no reason to suggest that's inaccurate. Frankly, that's terrifying. It's not something that I ever thought that I would hear. But certainly, if a law enforcement agency like the Sonoma County Sheriff's Office has such power over, the immigrant workers that come to Sonoma County, because, oh my gosh, don't we need them? I mean, they are the economy of Sonoma County.
Yeah.
They have such power, to threaten expulsion, to take people away, to disappear them and send them away, and their families don't know what happened. If they have that kind of power, such that the consulate, the representative of the government of Mexico in this area is saying, please don't do anything that'll anger them. wow, have we got a bigger problem than maybe a lot of us ever realized. And maybe that population is so much more vulnerable than those of us even in this line of work have ever
absolutely,
realized.
Absolutely, because it immediately emboldens the cops to know that they don't have to worry, but when they hear about from the Mexican consul, it's in support, not because they're representing the citizens that as they should be. If this, if the family is correct here and telling the truth, you're right. This is not a happy turn of events. So where exactly does this go now? Have you filed papers? Is the what is the family asking to happen? What are they saying about this video cover up? Do they feel it's a cover up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think most critical thinking people know that it's a cover-up, not just in how the video was produced, but in how the story was released, you know, how it was metered out little bit by little bit to tell, you know, to really color the events in a way that would make the sheriff's office seem less culpable. So, yes, absolutely. As far as what happened next, we filed a notice of claim with the county. The county has a certain amount of time to respond to that notice, after which time then the family has the right to sue. And we have a lawsuit that's prepared, filing that in federal court, alleging violations of David's constitutional rights, to which he is every bit as much entitled as a natural-born citizen of this country. And we will be pursuing this and seeking justice for the family. Unfortunately, you know, this is not the first time for the sheriff's office in Sonoma County. It's not even close. So it's
I'm remembering a cop by the name of Gelhaus. How many shots was it to the back and the side of Andy Lopez, the 10-year-old?
Eight shots in three seconds. 13-year-old.
He walked.
Not only did he walk, he was promoted.
He was promoted, got his pension, the whole thing. Yeah. Well, we hope... Mr. Schweiger, that you will keep us posted on this case. We're very interested in it. And if the family, whenever the family wants to talk about this, or if they have take it to the next level, they have an open microphone here. Please let them know.
I will do that, Dennis.
All right. You stay safe, and we will follow up on this story. Troubling situation. If people want more information, is there a way? Are community groups involved? Is there an activist group that people can get in touch with? What do you suggest? Because a lot of people listening to this show are not happy about this.
Oh, well, there's not a lot of reason to be happy about it. But I would say that the North Bay Organizing Project in Santa Rosa has been great at bringing attention to this and working with the family to get some justice.
Yes.
So that's an amalgamation of people from different disciplines and labor and social work and whatnot, but just to find a bunch of folks. And so if people are interested in helping or knowing more, contact the North Bay Organizing Project for sure.
Thank you, sir. Please stay safe.
Take care. You too.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to find out why a whole bunch of Filipino activists are not happy with the invitation of the Marcos Jr. to the United Nations, because they don't feel he's a legitimate president, that he didn't win the election, that there was a lot of hanky-panky. We're going to talk about that. Stay with us. Revolution from Flowering Inferno on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Thanks, Mike. Beautiful music. Mike Biggs makes this program sound well. Thank you, our technical director, as always. I'm Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And we're going to turn our attention to, there are many Filipino community activists and citizens and folks who are not happy with the invitation that Marcos Jr. Just got to the United Nations. Folks do not feel like he won the election fairly. And we're going to talk to one of them. There's some protests coming up. He was invited to the United Nations, but they're going to be protesting his arrival. Joining us to talk about this is Abby Arrastan. She is a community organizer with Gabriela in Santa Cruz, and she's concerned with a whole bunch of other people about what's going on here. So, Abby, welcome to Flashpoints. It's good to have you with us. Could you give us a little bio background on Marcos Jr. and why people have a problem? Y'all say he wasn't fairly elected.
Hi, yeah. Thank you, Dennis, for having us on the show. Yes, a lot of us are incredibly agitated about this situation, and especially, you know, part of it is the history of the Marcos family, right? We have Marcos Sr., who was his father in the 70s and 80s, who had a dictatorship over the Philippines for about 16 years, declared martial law, and under his rule, there was, you know, thousands and thousands of tortures, killings, disappearances, political prisoners. So this is already, you know, and then including the economic peril that he left on the Philippines by really inflating the debt of the people and really stealing their wealth and selling out the country to other foreign interests. And so that's part of it, right?
We should say that the only history, the only information that the United States, the general corporate media gave you is that Imelda Marcos liked Jews.
Yeah.
Go on.
A lot of people sort of don't know the real history behind
she liked a lot of shoes, right? Yeah. Go on.
Yeah, so that's already, you know, he doesn't have a great track record already right off the bat.
And does this she have track shoes? Oh, go on. I'm sorry.
Yeah, this past election season, throughout this past first half of the year, 2022, the elections leading up, we already were trying to monitor closely what was the campaign looking like. Across his campaign platform, he didn't have really any clear platforms that he was campaigning on. He was really just receiving a lot of money from these people who are CEOs or have interests and foreign interests, things like that. So we were seeing, right, he doesn't have a clear platform. And then on top of that, the manner of the elections this past year in the Philippines were really, really stained with violence and corruption. There were the vote counting machines were malfunctioning all over the country. There was incredibly long wait times. There was vote buying, instances of vote buying. So people would be handing out, you know, 500, 1,000, 5,000 pesos just to get folks to Bongbong Marcos Jr. and his slate of candidates. And just overall, a lot of voter disenfranchisement across the country, and including for overseas voters as well. Even in the Bay Area, there were instances of people who couldn't vote because their names were misspelt or it wasn't sent to the right address. You know, so many different ways of trying to limit the ability of a lot of different people to vote, especially in the Philippines, where voting throughout history has been stained by corruption and stained by you know, those in power trying to stay in power. A lot of people already get disheartened by the vote, by voting in general. But this past campaign, we saw a really large opposition slate with Lenny Robredo's slate. There were people campaigning door to door. There were tens to hundreds of thousands of people at her rallies across the country. So we saw that there was actually a large voice of Filipino people who wanted someone who wasn't Marcos Jr. And instead, within 24 hours, which is also sort of ridiculous, right, having an election called within 24 hours, he was already announced the president. So we were upset. We were disheartened and really outraged at this result, because it wasn't it wasn't democracy. It wasn't the voice of the people. It was the voice of the wealthy elite, the voice of a few who want to already pull the strings of the Philippines and the Philippine government.
And of course, this could have been a time for a real recovery, because Duterte, the prior leader, was to say that he was a vicious, murderous dictator, acting like an elected official, is to put it mildly. So it would seem that I imagine Marcos inherited the support. How did that work? Was Marcos carrying the torch?
Well, the almost more ridiculous thing is, it wasn't just Marcos who was on this candidacy. It's also Sara Duterte, or the previous president's daughter. So they were able to rally both of those camps of people who were supporting these two really tyrants, right? So I wouldn't say that Marcos and Duterte are like really close or really. You know, they actually disagree on a lot of things, and they aren't really always aligned, but they have the same interests of holding on to power in the Philippines.
Right.
And that allowed for their connection to really prosper,
I guess. And the history of the son, you know, in terms of Marcos, the history and the familial history and the way in which Marcos collaborated with the United States government to essentially, they practiced for what they would do in Vietnam in the Philippines.
Yep.
So the suffering was immense, and to come back with Marcos Jr. is certainly an extraordinary insult. I imagine the Americans supported him. Or no?
Oh, before the election was even fully finalized, President Biden and Secretary of State Anthony Blinken were him and congratulating him, already legitimizing this election, which was, you know, even more of a slap in the face for a lot of us who even grew up and were born here, right? To see that they were already trying to protect Marcos and legitimize his presidency, it was really frustrating to see.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Abby Aristan. She's a community organizer with Gabriella. She is working on issues that have everything to do with life in the Philippines and life here for Filipinos, because this goes both way. There are many of your countrymates in this country who care a lot about what's going on. There's a lot that goes back and forth. So you all are planning an action. Marcos was invited to the United Nations, and you all are not happy about it. Could you talk a little bit about the kinds of plans you have to greet Marcos at the UN?
Yeah, so there's going to be a couple different actions actually across the entire country, especially over in the East Coast, because that's where the UN headquarters are, right? But on September 19, Sara Duterte will actually also be visiting this country. She will be attending the Transforming Education Summit at the UN on September 19, which is really frustrating, because she was appointed the head of the Secretary of Education, the Department of Education in the Philippines, which is incredibly agitating, because one of the most important aspects of understanding politics is understanding the history. And there's a real fear that she is going to be vested in really limiting our access to history, as well as restarting the ROTC program to try and recruit more and more youth into the military and police, which we don't want them joining that because it's really dangerous. It really severely affects a lot of people, and it's not a sustainable lifestyle for most people in the Philippines. So there will be an action in reaction to her attending the Transforming Education Summit, and there will also be actions across the country, but especially in New York, and we'll be out in San Francisco as well on September 20th. In San Francisco, we'll be outside of the Philippine Consulate at around 6 p.m. We'll have a program where we'll hear from martial law survivors, we'll hear from community organizers, and we'll also pay tribute to those who were martyred by martial law, because a big part of Marcos's victory was the erasure of those who were affected by martial law, by the martyrs, by the survivors of the torture and the political prisoners, etc. So we really want to highlight the struggle that they went through and show that we can't go back to this same repressive regime. We can't go back to the same economic policies that put the Philippines in peril. And we can't go back to martial law, where so many people who want better for their country and better for their people were really targeted, and even to the point of being tortured or killed.
And it's also important to remember that the Philippines really took a very hard hit around the pandemic, and that was that created multiple struggles, and it wasn't helped in any way by Duterte, who apparently made it a lot worse. So there's a lot to recover from.
Yeah. And even they recently put out the budget for the Philippine government in 2023, and they're cutting all of the COVID aid. There's going to be no more what we call ayuda for the people. And they're already claiming that COVID is gone. They don't have to worry about COVID anymore. The economy is booming. But if you look at the numbers, it's definitely not booming. The debt has skyrocketed. The Philippine peso continues to plummet in its value. And COVID is very much still real and still rampant amongst the communities. So yeah, that's also a huge aspect. Thank you for bringing that up.
All right. Well, if people want listening either in the Bay Area, in Los Angeles, around the country, what's the best way to, one, find out information if there's an action happening in their city? And how can people get more information about the general movement, about what people are doing, how the actions that people might be taking to make a difference in the Philippines?
Yeah, so these actions are being held down by a couple different organizations. One of them is Bayan. So if you look up Bayan USA on Google, on Instagram, on Facebook, you'll see, actually, I think we've been posting a lot of infographics with different actions across the country, and even lead-up actions like screenings of martial law era films, press conferences, even interviews with martial law survivors. So Bayan USA will have a lot of information. Malaya Movement as well. They do a lot with when it comes to legislative work, as well as ICHRP, or ICHRP, International Coalition for Human Rights in the Philippines. All three of these organizations, in collaboration with other more sectoral organizations like Gabriela, which is for the women's sector, which I organize in, as well as Anak Bayan for youth and students, LFS for youth and students, League of Filipino Students. All of these organizations, we all work in tandem with each other, and especially in response to the Marcos Duterte, U.S. Marcos II regime. So Bayan, Malaya Movement, ICHRP, all of those organizations will point you to actions that are happening around you.
And you are associated with Gabriela, and if people want to communicate with you, what's the best way to do that?
Yes, I work with Gabriela Santa Cruz. We are probably most responsive on our Instagram because we work with a lot of students, and students use Instagram. Okay. But we also have an email as well.
Hear that, students? Go on. We care about the students. We do. That's why you're with us now.
True. Yeah. The students have they were actually very important in the era of martial law history because their response was, helped people feel energized and willing to fight back against the the martial law regime. And so we have an important role even now as well. So you can find Gabriela members at Gabriela USA. There's a website as well, Instagram, Facebook for Gabriela USA. And I work with Gabriela Santa Cruz. So we're GabrielaSC.slugs if you ever want to get in connection.
Three cheers for Gabriela. Thank you. And we're not going to talk about shoes, but we want, we certainly would like people to have all the things they need to survive in a Philippines that has a humane leader and not another Marcos. I mean, that's troubling. An insult, really.
Thank you.
To you all. So I'm apologizing for America and all the terrible things they did. You take care now.
Thank you.
Abby, and thanks for all the good information. Stay in touch, okay?
Yes, thank you for the interview. Have a good evening.
You're welcome. Good evening. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Laughter is healing. There's no question about that. And we need to do some serious healing in this country, in this world, if we're going to make it into the next decade. I'm worried. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are worried at this program about Julian Assange. I think he's in more danger than ever, thanks to the American liberals and their extreme use of censorship. Yeah, it's a big problem now, and it's getting worse. We're going to share with you some music. I think we have the refined piece that I did with our good friend Francisco Herrera. We wrote a little tribute to Julian Assange, and then we're going to tell you about what's going on with Randy Credico. He's been carrying around some banners in a very interesting way. And we're going to hear from Jeff Mackler, because there's a lot of protest. There's a lot of organizing going on. And Roger Waters has got a tour. He's coming to San Francisco in defense of Julian Assange. So there's a lot to say. Stay with us.
Free!
Julian Assange!
As a journalist, I saw that we could achieve a lot of reform with a little bit of work. In some cases, one classified video can possibly stop a war.
A military chopper opens fire. Instruments of genocide. WikiLeaks unmask the lie. Command, gunsight video nails the murder scene down. Julian told the truth about the war machine. It's getting late in the hour, don't wait another minute to speak truth to power.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are this program, Flashpoints, which really believes in investigative reporting, in truth-telling. We consider ourselves sort of a canary in the coal mine of corporate disinformation. Julian Assange did some extraordinary journalism and was an amazing publisher. And he's being punished by oh God, I just keep thinking about the Queen. Who's going to take care of those dogs? I don't think they need the Queen. Anyway, Julian Assange called out the Americans and the British. They, among the releases that has gotten under the skin of the powers that be is a video that I'm sure those who listen to the show have heard about called Collateral Murder. and it essentially puts the lie to the sort of the humanitarian wars that we keep hearing about conducted by the United States government. Collateral murder. It shows a U.S. helicopter gunship, I believe it was a U.S. gunship, first getting permission to open fire from central control and then carrying out a slaughter. Joining us to talk about the battle to save the life of Julian Assange, as I said, is Randy Credico and Jeff Mackler. Randy, could you talk a little bit about what you've been up to in the streets of Washington, D.C., with those mobile units calling to save the life of Julian Assange? What's been going on, and what's the response? I heard you when I talked to you earlier today, you were sort of in between screaming at people who were passing by to pay attention to Julian Assange. What's up?
Well, that was on, I don't even remember, that was Farragut station at 5 o'clock. I had been at George Washington University earlier, and the station there, and there's, you know, all the college students and high school students. The high school students actually were more receptive than the college students there, and everybody's walking around with their cell phones, you know, like it's the invasion of the body snatchers. It's very difficult to organize. That being said, we've been here beginning August 8th in the dog days of summer with a four-sided billboard truck, 15 by 8 and a vertical half that size and something up front with rotating signs. And I mean, they're expensive to put these things up, but we've had everything from Roger Waters designing one side. What you just alluded to, the collateral murder, we have a picture of collateral murder, that shot of those journalists being killed, and a picture of Julian Assange in that dreadful Belmarish courtroom behind a Eichmann-style glass box. And, you know, those guys are free. Those guys are still free. The message, those guys who murdered those children, and just a drop of the bucket of the murders that went on, and that video and that picture that with the crosshairs. And then next you say, these guys are still on the loose. And, you know, the attorney general knows where they are. They're walking the streets of the United States. They murdered people. And then the guy who exposed it is in a jail cell right now, incommunicado. He's Beethoven without a piano, basically. And it's saying, and the sign says, jail the killers, not the messenger. And so there's also, and I have one with President Biden shaking hands or giving the bump to Mohammed bin Salman, saying, I won't mention Khashoggi as long as you don't mention Assange. So we've got these with more image than dialogue on there, because people got short attention spans. And so we've been driving around the city and parking in different locations, and the reception has been incredible, so much so that Ben Cohen of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream has pledged, and I also have a Greek guy whose father and grandfather were both killed in the coup of 67 and one in the Civil War of 47 in Greece, who's anonymous, who's been supporting this truck and going around the city 10 hours a day. It illuminates at night, and trying to organize, trying to get the word out there, you know, doing whatever we can. As you know, this is not, he's been smeared so badly, and as he's been smeared, it's been well orchestrated, the lies, that's another one. They lied on him, they lied about him, they spied on him, and they tried to kill him. And so that's what they did with Assange. And we put that Yahoo News piece on there. Not that Yahoo News is the greatest investigative vehicle, but they got that one right, and it's God bless them for doing that. And we accept anything that's positive here. And so that kind of stuff, we keep shifting around. One, it's time to reunite Julian with his family. And so you got a picture of him, and you got Stella and the two kids below. I wake up every day. I got to tell you something. I've been involved in a lot of causes, as you know, particularly prison stuff. I wake up every day. This is the last one for me. I'm getting old. I don't have the street energy that I used to, but I'm giving it all I can.
Well, it's good, and you're Randy Credico.
And so that's the fact that it's time to release him and reunite him with that family, for Christ's sakes. So that's when I wake up to everything. I think Jeff.
Well, listen. Let me just jump in here, because there's a lot of people who agree with you, including Dan Ellsberg, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Chris Hedges, Alice Walker, and a whole bunch of them are going to be with Jeff Mackler and myself, if all goes well, at an event this Saturday, September 17th, and joining us to talk about that in this event, Free Assange, Free Mumia, Free Palestine, is Jeff Mackler. Jeff, you want to give us a sense of why you've jumped in with both legs and what's coming up?
Magnificent Jeff? Rally. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. It's going to be a magnificent rally this Saturday, the 17th, at 7 o'clock at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley. And the themes are Free Assange, Free Mumia, and Free Palestine. Palestine is the world's, Gaza is the world's largest open-air prison, incarcerating 2,000 Palestinians who are not allowed to leave unless they go to Israel to work at near slave wages. Mumia is going to be here in person with his remarks, but we have a surprise guest. His grandson, Jamal Jr., is going to be with us. Alice Walker is going to be with us reading three poems, one for Gaza, one for Mumia, and one for Julian Assange. We have Julian Assange's national leadership. Vincent DiStefano from the National Coordinating Committee is going to be with us. He and I are on the National Coordinating Committee of Assange Defense. Alice Walker is going to be here in person. She's a national co-coordinator of Assange Defense. And Dan Ellsberg is going to be here with us with video. We have too many speakers, including wonderful people like Susan Schnall, who's the president of Vets for Peace, Nozomi Hayashi, who's the author of the book WikiLeaks, Fourth Estate, and a whole host of other wonderful speakers. We have four Palestinian organizations on board as co-sponsors and endorsers, leaders of the Middle East Children's Alliance and the Palestinian Youth Movement. We have Chris Hedges by video, and we have Violette, who is a UC Berkeley graduate and a leader of the Middle East Children's Alliance. Francisco Herrera will be performing his magnificent song, Free Julian, which Dennis played, and we will also have featured speaker Dennis Bernstein, who has spent
Dennis didn't play. Dennis doesn't play, but Julian. Dennis wrote the words with Francisco Herrera, and it was an honor because he is an extraordinary troubadour. Randy, what? Talk to us just a little bit about what people can do and where they can tap into this. What has Roger Ward has been able to make an impact? I understand he's heading out here. Go on.
Yeah, the show is great. In all the Palestine, everything is featured in this 2-hour extravaganza by Roger. There's nothing like it in my life. You know, I've been in show business for 50 years, from Louis Armstrong and seeing the La Traviata, whatever. This is the greatest show I've ever seen on stage, and Roger Waters is brilliant. He's the finest songwriter of our time, musician, music maker, the greatest activist. He's a Paul Robeson type right now, but he's got this incredible show. And 16,000, I was in Raleigh, 16,000 people in Raleigh, and he spends 5 minutes, 6 minutes talking about Assange, about U.S. war, Black Lives Matter, Palestine, homelessness, everything. But it's a must-see show. I'm going to go see it for the
Do you have the dates for when he's in San Francisco?
Well, Jeff can tell you about that. It's very soon. It's all, it's in the next 2 weeks,
all right? Okay. All right.
I'm going to follow up. It's having an impact. It is having an impact. You've got all these people on their cell phones now listening, watching.
Okay. Everybody tune in tomorrow, because we're going to have lots of information on that. Jeff, give us the rundown one more time in terms of Saturday and your best shot at why you're doing it.
We are uniting these three issues: free Julian Assange, free Mumia, free Palestine. We have 15 magnificent speakers, including the co-national chairs of Assange's defense, leaders of Mumia's struggle, four Palestinian organizations, all this Saturday, September 17th at 7 p.m. at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley. Come and participate. We have a hall of 600 people. We want to fill it. There'll be magnificent tables. And we are organizing for the following week to mobilize people at the two concerts that Roger Waters is organizing at the Chase Center, which holds 19,000 people. So we're going to be passing out tens of thousands of flyers a week after our event, where we have free tickets. We're going to saturate the crowd. Randy is 100% right. This is a world-class concert. It's going to 28 cities and talking to millions of people about Julian's case, as well as Palestine, social justice, anti-war, and magnificent music. So join us this Saturday the 17th in Berkeley, 7 p.m. Meet the speakers, shake their hands, sign up to be a supporter, and join the struggle for free Assange, free Mumia Abu-Jamal, free Palestine.
And beautiful. You can contact and I'm give me you the...
at jmackler@lmi.net. That's jmackler, M-A-C-K-L-E-R, at lmi.net for more information.
Randy, last word. How is Julian doing? How are things on the home front? How is he doing?
I don't know. There's a lot of things going on. Look, his situation's dire. You can imagine the guy hasn't gotten any sunlight in 12 years. He's in the Tower of London, basically on the ground floor with a lot of noise all the time. You know, in the psychologically and physically, he was already bad going in there. As Niels Melzer pointed out, going in there on April 11, 2019, it's been 3.5 years he's been stuck in this hole. He's a prisoner of war. He is the war on the press. He is the first victim, or he's one of the first victims, but longest serving prisoner of war on the press. And that's what he is. He's a political prisoner, and he's stuck. And they want him badly. We got with Jeff and the crew out there. It's one of the finest in the country, the mobilizing effort that they have out there, and it serves as a model for cities around the country. I really appreciate what they do and admire it, and continued success.
Amazing. All right. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Randy. Appreciate you both coming on Flashpoints and all the great work you both do. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I have just a minute or so left, and I have to make this comment. I noticed that the preeminent John Yoo of the University of California at Berkeley, law professor, who wrote the justification for the Bush torture program. You know, the same one that Nicole Wallace helped to justify. Nicole Wallace, she does 2 hours a day on MSNBC. Bush administration torture. Well, John Yoo came out today and he said, well, Trump's guilty. He broke the law. It's true, but really, you need to think twice. Do you really want to prosecute a former president who was on television and stuff? John Yoo, this guy should be tried. Really, in my opinion, this guy and all those folks who participated in selling the torture program to the U.S. government and then perpetrating it on people of the world should be prosecuted. I think I'm just about out of time, but John Yoo, he doesn't think our esteemed professor at down the block here at the University of California, Berkeley, maybe doesn't think it's a good idea to go after Trump. I guess he didn't commit enough crimes. My name is Dennis Bernstein. The show is Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and there's steam coming out of my ears.
And that wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.